Thank you all for attending. We're here for the public comment on proposed changes to the Code of Judicial Conduct. I'll tell you that Chief Justice Malarkey is unable to attend this session. With that, we have an order of speakers, and I'd ask all of our speakers if they would please try to adhere to the time limit we've set, unless the court has a lot of questions and causes you to lose some time. And if not, somebody will remind you of that. Our first speaker is Eileen Kernan Johnson, who is counsel to the Chief Justice and one of the staff persons on the Judicial Code Committee. Eileen?
Justice Penrell, maybe you should clarify that the Chief Justice will be participating in the decision, but
yes, of course you will. Yes. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Eileen Kernan Johnson. And as Justice Bender noted, I served as a staff member for the Judicial Code Committee. I'm here on behalf of the committee to provide a brief overview of some of the major changes that are contained in the proposed code. I plan on only touching on many of those changes, although they are important. I plan to devote the bulk of my time to the one area that has generated some controversy. Of course, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have along the way. First, as you've no doubt noted, the format of the new proposed code differs significantly from Colorado's existing code. The ABA spent a substantial amount of time revamping the structure. So as opposed to the 9 canons that we currently have in the existing code, the ABA streamlined the code and condensed it into 4 to better organize it in a more coherent way. So the first canon deals with the overarching duties to uphold the independence and integrity and impartiality of the judiciary and to avoid impropriety in its appearance. The second code deals with on-the-bench conduct, the third with off-the-bench conduct, and the fourth with political activity. From the committee's first meetings, they viewed it as very important to adopt this new structure, both because of the time the ABA had spent on it and because it seemed to simply make more sense. But the committee added one piece to that structure, which they also viewed as very important, and that is the inclusion of annotations. And those annotations are citations to Colorado case law and judicial ethics advisory opinions, as well as opinions from other merit selection states. The idea is to provide one umbrella document that judges can turn to for guidance on how to conform their conduct. Some commentators have complained that there's an overrepresentation of certain states' opinions, and that's merely because some states happen to publish more on these issues, and we took what we could find in including cases in the annotations. Turning to the substance of the code, one of the first important new changes can be found in Rule 1.1, which is directed to compliance with the law. Our committee was a little concerned about some ambiguity as to that language and decided to introduce 2 new comments, one of which clarifies that judges can only be disciplined for more serious failures to comply with the law in their personal conduct, such as when they engage in some conduct that amounts to a criminal violation. And second, it imposes a new obligation on judges to self-report certain criminal convictions to the Judicial Discipline Commission. This obligation is parallel to but independent of the obligation on attorneys to self-report to the Office of Attorney Regulation Council. In Rule 3.4, which addresses service on governmental boards and commissions, the committee introduced another new comment. And that was designed to provide judges with greater latitude to serve on these boards and commissions in the wake of the controversy over the Judicial Ethics Advisory Board test, the direct nexus test. And this was designed to overrule that and signal to judges that they are encouraged to serve on such commissions. In Rules 313 through 315, these rules contain the requirements for reporting extrajudicial compensation, waivers, reimbursements, and so forth. Here, the committee was looking at one set of requirements in our old code that seemed to differ significantly from what the statutes required. And the committee wanted to streamline those requirements and make one set of requirements for judges, so there would be less confusion about what, on the one hand, they had to do under the code, on the other hand, under the statutes. So the committee simply made changes to track and reflect what the General Assembly already decided that public officials, including judges, should report. And that's where those particular changes come from. Finally, I flag for you that in Rule 4.1, in Comment 6, judges are allowed to attend election caucuses. The Colorado Committee didn't make a change from the ABA language here, but I'm pointing it out only because it marks a departure from existing Colorado practice. The ABA's reasoning was that even though a caucus participant might be required to stand in favor of a particular candidate, moving to the south side of the high school gymnasium if they favored candidate A, or the north side if they favored candidate B, this shouldn't be counted as a prohibited endorsement, because in such circumstances there's no other way to vote or express a preference for a candidate. Our committee found the ABA's reasoning sound and adopted that principle. Now I'd like to turn to the one area that has generated some controversy, which is Comment 2 to proposed Rule 2.6. The committee wrote this comment, adopted it, to address the problem created by the increasing number of pro se litigants. Our committee included a number of chief judges who strongly supported inclusion of some language to give judges on the ground some guidance as to what to do in such cases. The handout that you all have and that's available to the public with the bailiff tracks the evolution of the various versions of the comment, starting from the initial language that our committee recommended, and that one begins with the notwithstanding Colorado case law to the controversy. That language is no longer really in play. A number of commentators pointed out that many problems could stem from inclusion of that language, and so that's largely been abandoned. Numbers 2 and 3 sort of reflect midterm positions, but what we're really focusing on now are the last two versions. And the core of the controversy here is around two matters. First, whether the liberally construed language, which is included in the enumerated steps a judge may take when presiding over cases involving self-represented litigants, could be read to impose on judges an obligation to abandon or excuse the procedural or legal requirements in a case. Some commentators have expressed concern that it's at odds with Rule of Civil Procedure 9 and that it's not appropriate for inclusion in an ethics code. Then second, part of the controversy is over whether the comment should include an explicit reference to the specifying that judicial review is foreclosed if a judge takes or fails to take the steps outlined in the comment. So taking them separately, first turning to the liberally construed language, I first note that this was a matter that our committee strongly endorsed. As I noted, we had a number of chief judges in the trenches who argued that their ability to effectively and efficiently handle pro se cases was hampered. They told us that they felt constrained by not being able to exercise practical problem-solving skills when dealing with these cases. This language was thoroughly vetted by them, and for that reason, I suggest his respect is entitled to some deference. Secondly, the language is permissive. It would allow judges flexibility if they need or wanted in a particular case to make accommodations. It would give them a tool that, in their discretion, they could exercise if they thought it would be useful. But judges wouldn't be obligated to do this. And even in jurisdictions where courts are required to liberally construe pleadings, they still hold self-represented litigants to the same legal and procedural standards. The Tenth Circuit, for example, has crafted an explanation of what it means to liberally construe pleadings that might be useful here. They've said that liberal construction means only that if the court can reasonably read the pleadings to state a valid claim, it should do so. But even in those cases, the courts haven't had any difficulty in liberally construing pleadings on the one hand, and on the other hand, ensuring that litigants follow the law and the procedural requirements. And I'd note that both of the versions of the comment that are in play contain explicit language in the last sentence stating that self-represented litigants are required to comply with the law and the procedural requirements. Last point on that issue, I'd note that this is a code of conduct. What we're trying to do here is give guidance to judges as to what they may or may not be disciplined for. We're also trying to give guidance to the Commission on Judicial Discipline as to what they can discipline judges for. Our judges have asked for guidance in this area, and while it might also be appropriate to address this issue elsewhere, I think at a minimum it does belong in the judicial code. Turning briefly to, very briefly, to the issue of appeals, I'd suggested tacking that language on here where the scope section already prohibits or forecloses appeals could generate confusion and could undermine the purpose of the provision. And finally, I would just ask the court not to delay this measure, as some of the commentators have requested. There's been some suggestion that it be deferred to certain rules committees, and I think that might cause a problem for several reasons, one of which, as I mentioned, our committee vetted this language in its over 2-year proceedings, but there's a question as to which committee it would go to, the appellate rules committee, the civil rules committee, the criminal rules committee, and what happens if they come up with differing language. And my fear is that it might just languish if it's deferred to another committee. So I respectfully request that the court take up consideration of this comment now in the context of the code, and if necessary, also consider it in the context of other rules. I see that my time has elapsed. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the court might have, and I thank you for your time.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, I do have a question. Kind of minor. It's about the comment to 2.6,
yes.
Comment 2 to 2.6, but it's not about the substantive and sort of principled arguments that have been made. Instead, I kind of wonder if it's just me or if anyone else with all the attention focused here had any difficulty with the use of the language, you know, plain English rather than legal jargon, which just kind of seems to grate on me a little bit. I kind of don't like referring to the way we normally speak about the law, legal jargon, and to a more clear explanation that a layperson might understand as plain English. And I just sort of wonder whether there were any other attempts to work with that language in a different way, or whether I'm the only one that apparently is having this reaction.
Well, that wasn't a matter that our committee spent a lot of time debating, so perhaps it didn't grate on their ears, but I think certainly they would be open to crafting some new language that might be a little bit more elegant and precise.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Ms. Vernon Johnson? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Our next speaker is Judge John Webb.
If the court please. In light of Ms. Kiernan Johnson's comments in the last iteration of comment 2 to Rule 2.6, I'll limit my time to 2 points. First, liberally construed pleadings should be referred to the Civil Rules Committee because any requirement of construction belongs in the civil rules. Second, the comment should contain language that it is not a standard of conduct. The intent isn't that any comment would foreclose a substantive right of appeal, but that the examples in the comment would not be a standard of conduct on which an appeal could be based. I see three problems with liberally construed pleadings. First, it has become a term of art in the federal courts as a result of the Haynes decision. While the Tenth Circuit may have taken the somewhat middle ground, other circuits have said that liberally construed pleadings requires the unrepresented litigant to be afforded any and all benefit. The only limitation appears to be where a specific rule of civil procedure requires a narrow construction, and the federal circuits have reversed numerous district court decisions because the trial judge did not liberally construe pleadings. Second, a decision by a trial court to liberally construe a pleading could be outcome determinative. We have cases in our court, for example, where cases have been dismissed for inadequate disclosures. Summary judgment has been granted because the unrepresented litigant did not appropriately identify and substantiate a disputed issue of fact. Were those decisions to be otherwise because the pleadings were liberally construed, those would be outcome determinative. Third, and perhaps most problematic from my perspective, is I believe such decisions as a practical matter are unchallengeable on appeal. The only basis for invoking the liberal construction, as now endorsed or apparent, possibly endorsed by the Code of Conduct, would be a litigant's unrepresented status, not the strength of the case. What exactly would be the standard for applying, or what the breadth of liberally construed, is unclear. And some of the rulings, for example, denying a motion for summary judgment because the trial court chose to construe the opposition liberally, is not appealable. I believe that this is more appropriately the province of the Civil Rules Committee for at least three reasons. First, that committee can address the obvious tension between liberally construed pleadings and the requirements of Rule 9. Second, pleadings is a narrow term under Rule 7A. The committee could determine whether, if there is going to be a liberal construction approach on some circumstances, that is limited to pleadings as so defined, or it in fact embraces any filing made by an unrepresented litigant. And third, and with respect to those who worked on this for a long time, it would seem to afford a greater opportunity for members of the bar who litigate against unrepresented litigants to be heard. If this court, as Ms. Kiernan Johnson suggests, believes it should move quickly and put this to rest, I suggest as an alternative to liberally construe pleadings, a phrase such as reasonable efforts to understand the position of the unrepresented litigant. Turning quickly to the second point, I'm also concerned that the examples in comment two would be asserted as a standard of conduct by the unrepresented litigant who says the trial judge did not do enough to assist me because he or she did not take all of the steps, set all of the examples, or by the represented litigant who said the trial judge showed bias in favor of the unrepresented litigant because the trial judge went beyond the examples given. It is not my suggestion that any language in the comment foreclose an appeal. The unrepresented litigant would still have the right to appeal, I suppose, on due process principles. The represented litigant would have a right to appeal because the judge showed bias. My point is that the language should clarify that the examples are not standards of conduct that would form the basis on which such an appeal would be decided. I've suggested to the court, and I believe the citation was communicated to you by Ms. Festig, a recent decision of our court in Hayman Contractors, that's at 2009 Westlaw 1152160, in which the panel held, citing a number of decisions from other states, that codes of ethics should not be standards of conduct. My time is exhausted. I would welcome the opportunity to answer questions.
I have a question for you. Other than being a split infinitive, what was your suggested language? Reasonable effort? I didn't quite understand. Replacing liberal?
I suggested, and I apologize for if I spoke too quickly, in lieu of liberally construed pleadings, a phrase such as, quote, reasonable efforts to understand the position of the unrepresented litigant, unquote. I believe that is preferable to liberally construe pleadings because the liberally construe pleadings phrase carries with it all the baggage of the federal courts having to deal with what was a fairly casual statement by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Haynes case.
Thanks. Does anybody have any questions of Judge Webb? Hearing none, thank you very much, Your Honor. Appreciate it. Your comments. Our next speaker is Judge Daniel Taubman.
Good Good afternoon. May it please the court, I am here as a person mentioned in the committee comment as one along with the Access to Justice Commission, who suggested that the Supreme Court adopt this comment to Rule 2.6. I'm also here as one of four judges of the Court of Appeals who sent you a letter supporting the adoption of the comment, as well as a member of the Colorado Access to Justice Commission. I will say at the outset that Judge Miller and Judge Arkin and I have coordinated our comments that we will present so as to avoid repetition this afternoon. I also I would like you to know that Magistrate Simon Mole of the Access to Justice Commission is also here this afternoon. I would like to step back for 1 minute from the comments and point out that the genesis of comment two is a series of 10 access to justice hearings that were held 2 years ago, and three of you, including Chief Justice Mularkey, attended some of the hearings. At all of those hearings, we had testimony from district or county court judges expressing their need for more guidance regarding what was permissible conduct for them in cases involving pro se litigants. As a result of that, as you may remember, at last year's judicial conference, we had a keynote speech by Chief Justice John Broderick of the New Hampshire Supreme Court, as well as two panel discussions on what's called Principles of Neutral Engagement, which is a new national approach for handling cases involving pro se litigants, which enable judges to provide additional information than has traditionally been the case to pro se litigants, while at the same time ensuring that they will be fair and impartial in every case. Coincidentally, Chief Justice Broderick, as you know, is going to be honored tonight by Becky Corliss's Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System. We think that it's important for there to be training for judges, as well as for attorneys, in the event that the Supreme Court adopts comment two or some version of comment two. I would also point out that I and my colleagues on the court and the Access to Justice Commission all support the most recent compromise that Ms. Kiernan Johnson spoke of just a few minutes ago. In my view, providing guidance to judges through the Code of Judicial Conduct is most important. My colleague Judge Webb has suggested in past discussions that this could simply be done by a judicial ethics advisory opinion. It seems to me that when we're talking about conduct of judges, there is no better place to do so than the Code of Judicial Conduct. Similarly, others have suggested that there be changes in rules of civil procedure or appellate rules. Well, such changes may be appropriate, but they're not inconsistent at all with having guidance provided to judges through the Code of Judicial Conduct. I would like to share with you a comment very similar to the one that you're considering that was adopted just a few months ago by the Ohio Supreme Court, which lists many of the same factors. And Justice Martinez, in response to your question about plain English and legal jargon, the phrase that's used in that comment is refraining from using legal jargon. So may I approach the bench, Justice Carter, sure, to distribute copies of
you may.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And then I would like to simply conclude by noting what Chief Justice Broderick said a year ago in a speech to the Wyoming Bar Association. He said, in part, "If the rules of judicial conduct need to be clarified or amended to provide judges with the necessary comfort to neutrally engage self-represented litigants, then the rules should be amended. So I would urge you to follow Chief Justice Broderick's lead and amend the rules according to the compromise. Was I short a couple of copies of that?
Myself and Justice Hyde would need those. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to make a presentation.
Thank you, Judge Tobin. Wait a minute. Does anybody have any questions? Justice Martinez does.
Yes, I do. I just wonder if you would react. I don't want to try to strike a compromise, another compromise here, but I just wonder if you would react to the suggestion or something like the suggestion that Judge Webb made for a change in the comment at the end of his presentation, which I'm not sure I wrote it down exactly, but I'm taking that as replacing the liberally construing language as something along the lines of attempting to understand positions or claims and not well articulated, something along those lines.
I think it was a reasonable effort to understand the position of the unrepresented party.
My response to that question is threefold. Number one, I have not had an opportunity to consider that, and although I've had the opportunity to discuss this issue numerous times with Judge Webb, this is the first time I have heard alternative language to that effect proposed. But second, off the top of my head, it sounds like it may be reasonable, but I would like the opportunity to consider it a little bit more and perhaps respond in writing within the next day or two to the court.
So I'm sure it's the essence of it as being, instead of using liberally construing, we're talking about understanding or
As I said, my initial inclination, Justice Martinez, is that the language may be okay. And my third point is that I do not share Judge Webb's concern about the language of liberally construing the pleadings. That language has been in use for 40 years in the federal courts, and it has not created any significant problems or difficulties for federal judges.
I understood that part clearly.
Okay.
I was really trying to get a reaction instead to, you know, something along the lines of understanding as opposed to liberally construing, and something along the lines of claims or positions instead of pleadings. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge Tobin.
Thank you again.
Our next scheduled speaker is Judge Gail Miller, Court of Appeals. Judge Miller.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Gail Miller. I am a member of the Access to Justice Commission and also one of the four Court of Appeals judges who signed the minority report that has been referred to. I want to make two points, because I think I can be pretty brief about it. One is to touch base a little bit about statistics about pro se litigants, and secondly, to make a couple of comments with regard to the language that's been discussed. Obviously, we all know that the judicial system was created by the people and for the people to provide them a way of peaceful and just resolution of disputes. For that to work, the decision makers, judges and juries, need to have the information that's necessary in order to make a just decision. And one of the problems is that we find that a very substantial percentage of folks participating in court proceedings are unrepresented. The State Court Administrator's Office does not maintain detailed statistics, really much statistics at all in regard to this, although their estimate is that at least 50% of litigants in domestic cases in our district courts are unrepresented. There is quite a bit of evidence from other states, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. In California, a study that was done in 2004 showed that more than one-third of the parties instituting unlawful detainer cases, eviction cases, were unrepresented, and 90% of the defendants were unrepresented. There is some studies that have been done in places like New Hampshire and Iowa which said that looking at all civil cases that are filed, it's somewhere between 50 and 60% of the cases, there is at least one party involved in those cases who is not represented by counsel. And in several states that have been surveyed, the percentages are somewhere between 65 and 80% of domestic relations parties who are not represented by counsel. So it's a pretty substantial number of people, and the problem, and that illustrates a problem of those folks, if they can't get the information that the judge or the jury needs, you run a risk of not getting good results. I do endorse the proposal that Ms. Kernan Johnson described, and just to comment on a couple of things, I think it is sort of universally agreed that maybe that the notwithstanding case law of the contrary is not the best language, but it's important to recognize that there is a perception by a number of judges that there are cases such as Loomis versus Seeley that preclude them from taking the kinds of steps that are listed in the comment. So we think it's very important that the Supreme Court, through this rule, provide clear guidance. We certainly don't object to including a sentence that pro se litigants are subject to the same rules and substantive procedures and law as represented parties, although I don't think that the proposal, even as originally made, really suggests in any way that pro se litigants are somehow exempt from, for example, statutes of limitations or complying with the Colorado appellate rules or the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure. However, adding such a sentence, if it adds clarity, is fine. I do have concerns about injecting specific language into this one comment that would preclude appellate review. As has been noted, paragraph 7 of the scope section establishes standards. If there needs to be more clarity, that would seem to be the place to put it. Rather than singling out this one section, which after all, this one comment, which after all is designed to provide, to promote public access to our courts. I suggest it's not a good idea to single out this one place as creating a special exemption from any appellate scrutiny. And it also creates confusion because people looking at other provisions can always argue that those other there's appeals to be taken from the scores and scores of other provisions of the code, because when the Supreme Court knew how to say that appeals are not possible, they put it into the code, and where they didn't, they obviously must have intended otherwise. So I would urge that that language not be included. With that, I want to thank you very much for your careful attention to this issue, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Does the court have any questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, Judge Miller. Our next speaker is Judge Angela Arkin. Court recognizes Angela Arkin. Judge Arkin.
May it please the court. I am also here to talk about comment 2 to Rule 2.6. I am also a long-standing member of the Access to Justice Commission and am very honored to be here today. My perspective on addressing issues with pro se litigants is a much more direct day-to-day perspective, and I want to just share with you a few brief points about those kinds of issues. Judge Webb's suggestion regarding the language of liberally construing pleadings, I certainly am fine with however that language needs to be. I just think that it's absolutely essential that judges be allowed and encouraged to do so. And if you think about access to justice, your first access to justice is the complaint that you file or the motion that you file or the response, which can be something like a letter in which somebody gives their perspective on why they think that the motion or complaint is inappropriate. This has been an issue in the federal courts, and they've dealt with it well enough through the Haynes versus Kerner decision and under Rule 9. But when you think about it in general pleadings, it's much more of a direct issue. And I'm just going to give you my Monday afternoon, where I was dealing with a magistrate's decision that had been appealed. And the remand on the appeal was because the magistrate did not liberally construe the pleadings, and the person was entitled to relief under Rule 60B rather than Rule CRM 7. And I was back having a hearing on the case 3 years later. The mandate had come down 2 years after the appeal, and it resulted in a dad not seeing his children for that two-year period of time. And I wish I could tell you that that was an extreme example. But that magistrate, like other judicial officers, doesn't have a clear direction as to liberally construing the pleadings and what those parameters are and should be. And it's very important for us to understand at the outset what we need to do when we're looking at pro se litigants and the pleadings that
Well, can I ask you to comment then on it, because you have the practical experience. What is it you need to do to provide access to justice, to understand what the position is that's being advanced through a pleading or even an argument? I'm assuming that trial judges are faced with this daily. So they're already giving some kind of explanation or guidance or using some kind of construction rubric. So what do you think is most appropriate from where you sit?
Well, if somebody doesn't understand what rule or what statute it is that they're relying on in their pleading or in their argument, but the judge or magistrate knows that it's a cognizable claim, the fact that they don't particularly cite that specific rule or case or statute, it should be considered by the court that they are making a cognizable claim, whether it be as a response or as a motion, et cetera. It's the basic issue of access. If you don't allow someone who has a cognizable claim in the court doors because they haven't specifically stated it in, whether you want to call it legal jargon or legal terms of art, if you will.
Can I just ask you a question?
Yes, ma'am.
So what if they cited one rule and really the appropriate rule would have been a different one? It seems to be your situation, although I don't know whether this person cited either. But what if they basically got it wrong? Does the judge under this comment have a responsibility to liberally construe and impose the correct rule?
I would say responsibility, not under this rule. I think
so even liberally construe doesn't go that far, if you would.
No, ma'am. I'm talking about your
responsibility. So it's more if they if you get a pro se pleading that just says nothing, then it would be your position that the judge under liberal construction should say what could be X or Y or Z, and I'm going to accept it on those grounds.
I think this is the term is may, but I will tell you that when I don't look at these things and determine if there is a cognizable claim, I get it back on appeal. Which isn't the reason that it should happen, frankly, but it is a reality. And if someone should have to wait for an appellate court to tell me I'm allowed to do this at the outset, then I don't see that as allowing these folks access in a real sense.
Yeah, obviously my question is just that, that kind of fuzzy line between liberally construing and lawyering for, and I guess that's what I'm trying to explore.
I, with all due respect, I think that judges and magistrates know where that line is. I don't advocate for folks, but when they make a cognizable claim, I allow them an opportunity to be heard. And that's really what from my perspective, liberally construing the pleadings is really about, can they come into the courthouse and state their claim and seek relief? And if you don't allow judges and magistrates to do that, then essentially our system of justice is closed to these folks. And I see my time is up. Are there any other questions?
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Judge Arkin.
Thank you.
Our next scheduled speaker is Mr. Paul Chan, President-elect of the Colorado Bar Association.
Good afternoon, Justice Bender, members of the court. Thank you for the opportunity to address you on behalf of the Bar Association. I would like to start by saying that the Bar Association recognizes and appreciates the need for effective access to justice for pro se litigants and the effective administration of the courtroom. And we in no way wish to minimize the problem or the challenges that the courts are facing in addressing this issue. I do want to give you just a little bit of context about the position that the bar has taken that's reflected in the October 13 letter that I believe you have. And also to explain the bar's position today. Our letter and the position that the bar reached was the result of consideration of the original proposed language that was presented to us and considered by the executive board in the first week of October. That language was distributed to all of our sections. We heard back from the sections. The executive committee considered their concerns and comments, and we arrived at the position that we would oppose the adoption of the comment as it was drafted at that time. I should be very careful to point out that a couple things that our letter is not, and that is it's not a suggestion that further considering this matter, the language and the proposed comment be referred to all of the rules committees that are available. We simply were suggesting some additional consideration by those committees that the court saw appropriate under these circumstances. And most importantly for today, our letter is not a consideration of the compromise language that's been proposed over as a result of the discussions over the last 2 weeks. Unfortunately, the Bar Association simply is not set up and has not been able to effectively and meaningfully review with our sections the proposed language, the proposed compromise language, and so I'm unfortunately not able to give you a position of the bar on the new language that's been presented to you. What I do think, though, these developments raise for you, the court, are two very significant questions, and that is first, given the long consideration over the past 20 months of the comment, and the strenuous objections that have been raised by the groups that have addressed the court both today and in the materials that have been provided to you, I think the court needs to decide if those objections are simply the statements of a small group of individuals that have come together here at the end of the process, or if somehow, with all due respect to those people involved in the preliminary considerations, if somehow there were broader concerns of the community that somehow were not reflected in those hearings and in those proceedings. Secondly, I think that given the significant revisions and compromises that have been presented and reached over the past 2 weeks, would it be more appropriate for the court to defer its decision on this particular comment and refer the matter back to an appropriate committee or committees for further consideration? Because as is consistent with the bar's position today, we simply just have not had the opportunity to seriously consider and effectively analyze those compromise proposals in order to give you a meaningful position. Unless the court has some questions for me, that's all that I wanted to present to you. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
Does anybody have any questions, Mr. Chan? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next speaker, that at least is scheduled, is Jonathan Asher, Executive Director of Colorado Legal Services. Court recognizes Mr. Asher.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, bureaucrats like me don't get to say that very often anymore. It is a pleasure to be with you. As Judge Bender said, I'm Jonathan Asher, and I have the pleasure of serving as Executive Director of Colorado Legal Services. Colorado Legal Services is the federally funded statewide provider of civil legal assistance to the indigent. We represent, with few exceptions, only those whose income is below 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. The guidelines are adjusted each year. Currently, an individual's income must be below $13,500, and a family of four, for example, must have an income below $27,500 a year to qualify for our services. That obviously is very low, and many above that cutoff clearly can't afford counsel. But the latest census estimates, nonetheless, reflect that as many as 600 to 650,000 residents in Colorado are eligible for our services. We currently have 50 lawyers, up a few from when the hearings were held 2 years ago. So we have one lawyer for every 13,000 eligible clients, approximately. Those who come to us for help are more likely to be turned away than to get legal assistance. But despite our services and the really invaluable pro bono help provided much through your efforts and that of the bar, we still turn away more than one person for everyone who calls or comes to our door. Now, many who do get help just get advice or brief service or pro se assistance when what they really need is a lawyer and representation. The most recent ABA study and those states that have studied it showed that probably somewhere around 20% of the legal needs of the indigent are met either by staffed or pro bono counsel. So the courts are seeing more and more pro se litigants. Some choose to go it alone, others have no choice. Of those without a choice, some manage okay, but most do not. So any guidance, support, permission for judges to ensure that justice is done is a step in the right direction. It's a help in ensuring not just access to the courts, but access to justice. So therefore, I support the proposed comment to Rule 2.6 as revised and support the position of the Access to Justice Commission and the views of Judge Taubman, Miller, and Arkin, and others who support the inclusion of the comment in the proposed rules. Thank you.
Are there any questions of the court? Mr. Asher, thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak on these issues? Hearing nothing, we'll conclude our hearing. I will say that the court will take all the oral statements and all of the written. We've got other email statements from various entities and people expressing views on most of the subjects that we have touched upon, and we'll consider them and make our decision in the relative near future. Thank you very much. This hearing is concluded.